to kick this thing off. Can I kick it off? One, two, three, boom.
Welcome back to another episode of World History Class with Mr. Lutz, where today's episode is a bit ambitious in scale, covering World War II and the beginnings of the Cold War. It sounds a bit ambitious, it felt a bit ambitious, but thankfully to our dear friends, those key concepts, I think it's made pretty manageable here. So be sure to check out the blog that I post on WordPress so you can see exactly what you need to know about World War II. To prevent yourselves from getting too overwhelmed about what exactly needs to be understood. And I think you'll have a good picture. But as always, lots to get to, so we'll begin right away. So as we've seen in the last few chapters, the effects of World War I and the Great Depression were severe and long-lasting. The Treaty of Versailles created conditions that were unfavorable to many, notably the Germans, who were forced to pay reparations, saw their air force and navy disbanded, a dramatic reduction in the size of their army, and the loss of territory both abroad and on the European continent. And the Great Depression put a strain on domestic economies as well, as nations resorted to economic nationalism when they created trade tariffs that reduced the flow of international trade. So this practice ended up creating further economic damage because it reduced industrial output due to lower global demand, and it complicated the importation of resources. Nations like Japan had decided to expand abroad to secure raw materials that allowed them to independently secure the resources necessary for increased industrial expansion, as opposed to relying on the United States for the importation of raw materials. So Hitler began taking gradual steps in the mid-1930s to reestablish German supremacy in the world, and he focused his plan on a remilitarization program. By 1935, he was bringing back Germany's air force and increasing the number of soldiers in his military. The following years, he placed soldiers back into the border region with France, known as the Rhineland. All three of these actions were in direct violation of the terms agreed upon by the Treaty of Versailles. Other nations, particularly Britain and France, would have been within their rights to take decisive military action against German remilitarization, but the generation ruling still felt the pain that had been inflicted upon them and their nation as a result of the First World War, and they were not looking to start a new war less than 20 years later. As a result, the strategy of appeasement, meaning to give in to one's demands so as to avoid conflict, became the operating norm when dealing with Nazi Germany. Hitler's quest for uniting all Germans into one state and Lebensraum, or living space, led him first to the Anschluss, meaning union with Austria in 1938, followed by his demanding that the Sudetenland, a territory in Czechoslovakia inhabited primarily by ethnic Germans, be annexed by Germany. Czechoslovakia's leader did not want to see this plan become a reality, but this strategy of appeasement followed by Britain and France resulted in their granting Hitler's demands and allowing Nazi annexation of the Sudetenland later in 1938. And by 1939, the Nazis had invaded and annexed all of Czechoslovakia. By 1939, it was clear that the strategy of appeasement had failed and more decisive action needed to be taken in response to German aggression. Hitler had his sights set on Poland next, but that nation was guaranteed protection by Britain and France. So if Hitler were to invade, it would mean war on the European continent once again. To avoid the disastrous strain Germany faced fighting a two-front war during World War I, Hitler and Stalin opted to sign the Nazi-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact in 1939, where the two nations pledged to not attack one another, while also agreeing to divide eastern and western Poland between themselves. With security on the Eastern Front guaranteed, at least for now, the Nazis were free to invade Poland and then deal with the Allied forces of Britain and France. The Nazi invasion of Poland took place on September 1, 1939, and war was declared by Britain and France. Now, Japan's quest for economic self-sufficiency led it on a path of imperial conquest through East and Southeast Asia, putting it on a collision course in the near future with the United States of America. Japanese forces invaded Manchuria in 1931, after staging an attack on their railway networks in the region and falsely blaming the Chinese for the attack. This event was used as a pretext to justify the invasion, which was naturally condemned by the League of Nations, of which Japan was a member during that time. In response to the criticism, the Japanese withdrew their membership from the League of Nations and proceeded to take more territory in Manchuria by 1932. It was during this same time, you'll recall, that the Chinese nationalist and communist forces were locked in a civil war over the fate of their country. Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the nationalists, or KMT, had been focusing his attention largely on eliminating the communist threat, but he realized the increasingly larger Japanese problem that had forced his hand into taking action. Chiang decided to create a united front with the Chinese Communist Party to combat the Japanese, and they engaged in their first battle in 1937. The Chinese were unsuccessful in holding off the Japanese, and soon enough Beijing, Shanghai, and the nationalist capital of Nanjing fell. The horrors of World War II were plainly evident in the actions of the Japanese against their Chinese foes. For instance, Shanghai civilians faced bombing raids from Japanese forces that resulted in the deaths of several thousand. What Japan became infamous for was their actions in the nationalist capital that eventually became known as the Rape of Nanjing, for it was here where Japanese soldiers raped Chinese women by the thousands, conducted bayoneting practice on Chinese POWs, forcing civilians to dig their own graves before being executed and thrown into them, and other acts of absolute horrific savagery that fail to be understood by any words that I could offer here. It is estimated that about 300,000 Chinese were killed in the Rape of Nanjing. The government of the United States began to place economic sanctions in response to the atrocities committed by the Japanese in China. As Japan began to set its sights into Southeast Asia, lands that were still under Western imperial control, they began to devise plans to prevent Allied retaliation. The Japanese moved into the Dutch East Indies and French Indochina, seizing control of valuable raw materials in the region in 1940, and faced an immediate embargo by the United States on oil and steel, which would continue unless the Japanese withdrew from their German and Italian alliance and withdrew their armies from the territories they had conquered over the past several years. The Japanese did not stand for these demands, and instead opted to take the path toward war. It was believed that an attack on the American naval fleet at Pearl Harbor would cripple any attempt by the U.S. to stop Japanese expansion throughout the Pacific. American naval power was significantly damaged, but not destroyed as a result of the events of December 7, 1941, and American public opinion immediately demanded revenge on the Japanese. America declared war on Japan, the Axis powers of Germany and Italy declared war on the United States, and now a monumental task was on hand for many citizens of the world to contribute to the fighting of another world war. So I want to talk about the nature of total war in this next portion as I outline the course of World War II. So pay attention to all the different tactics, strategies, technologies, and victims as this war dragged on. You should have a general awareness of the course of the war, but more importantly, an understanding of what made this a total war. So the Nazi tactic of blitzkrieg, or lightning war, using rapid troop movements, devastating air attacks, and the movement of tank divisions, left enemies unable to respond to such fast and surprising attacks. These tactics allowed the Germans to conquer Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium, and France all by the spring of 1940. This achievement was made possible because Hitler had devoted the energy of his citizens and the productivity of German industry to building a monumental war machine, as well as the willingness of the Nazis to conduct war against civilian populations as well. In 1940, the Dutch city of Rotterdam was bombed to pieces and lost 40,000 of its citizens as a result of Nazi air raids. It was also during this same time that the Battle of the Atlantic was being waged as German submarines, called U-boats, were targeting and destroying Allied ships carrying munitions or food either for its soldiers or citizens. The British had invested significant research and collective brain power in cracking the German naval code so they could determine U-boat movements. You should definitely check out the movie The Imitation Game to see this aspect of the war being fought by the minds of Britain. Now, after Hitler's successes on the continent, he was really only left to deal with Great Britain as of 1940. Their strategy to bring the island nation to its knees, known as the Battle of Britain, was to bomb larger cities into submission, thus forcing a British surrender. However, this plan was not to succeed for a multitude of reasons. The Nazis were unable to destroy air defenses. Radar technology began to allow the British to detect and defend against incoming attacks, and Prime Minister Winston Churchill's leadership was instrumental in helping to boost British morale with words such as, quote, "Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grip of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of Nazi rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and the oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." End quote. It was lines like this that truly illustrate the nature of total war that defined the Second World War. 1941 was a year in which the Allied forces grew. Operation Barbarossa, the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union, was launched as the security provided by the Non-Aggression Pact was thrown out the window. By the end of that year, the Germans had reached the outskirts of both Leningrad, formerly St. Petersburg, and Moscow. However, the Soviet winter caught a German army that expected quick victory in an unprepared state. The Soviets were able to repel the German offensive briefly before the tide swung again in the German favor. The Americans were also attacked the same year at Pearl Harbor by December of that year and had entered the war. 1942 was when the Battle of Stalingrad occurred. This attack was meant to cripple railroads that helped facilitate oil shipments throughout the Soviet Union. The Soviets refused to concede the city and lost over 1 million soldiers in defending it, while the Axis forces lost about 250,000, but faced a total casualty rate of about 800,000. This, quite possibly, is the largest battle in terms of individuals fought in the history of the world. Meanwhile, Allied victories in North Africa against the Nazis that same year opened up the possibility of invading Europe through Italy. June of 1942 saw a U.S. victory in the Pacific on the tiny island of Midway, where American codebreakers cracked Japanese naval codes and were able to put up a significant dent into the strength of the Japanese Navy. The U.S. would be on the offensive now as they grinded their way through the Pacific to Japan in a campaign that was known as island hopping. 1943 and 44 saw the Axis forces fighting almost entirely defensive wars. By the summer of 1943, the Allies had made significant inroads into Italy, overthrowing Mussolini and taking control of Rome by June 4, 1944. 2 days later, June 6, 1944, was when the invasion of Normandy in northern France, known as D-Day, was launched. Allied troops stormed the beaches in waves, paratroopers were dropped in behind enemy lines, and supplies were transported in unimaginable quantities across the English Channel to supply the Allies in their movements across Western Europe and eventually into Germany. The Allies took control of Normandy and were able to set their sights on Berlin. By the end of 1944, the Germans threw one last desperate counterattack at the Battle of the Bulge, which ultimately failed. In the east, the Soviets had been pushing back the Germans since their success at the Battle of Kursk. In the Pacific during 1943 and 1944, the island hopping campaign was experiencing success, though at a somewhat costly rate. Finally, 1945 saw the end of the war on both fronts. The Soviets had begun to claim Eastern Europe from the Germans and were racing to Berlin from the east by April of that year, while British and American forces were closing in on the Nazi capital from the west. On April 30th, Hitler committed suicide in his bunker in Berlin, only 2 days after Mussolini had been killed by members of the Italian resistance. May 8th of 1945 marks Germany's official surrender, and VE, meaning Victory in Europe, Day was declared. In the Pacific, two costly American victories at Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and the refusal of the Japanese emperor to surrender, forced difficult decisions to be made. The Japanese had convinced soldiers to serve as kamikazes, flying their planes suicidally into American ships, as well as convincing their civilians not to surrender. Fearing the casualty rate that would result in a ground invasion of Japan, President Harry Truman of the United States decided to use the newly developed atomic bomb, first on Hiroshima on August 6th and, after no sign of Japanese surrender, on Nagasaki on August 9th. Together, these bombs killed nearly 150,000 Japanese immediately and poisoned thousands of others due to the radiation they were exposed to. By August 15, 1945, the Japanese surrendered to Allied forces, and VJ, meaning Victory in Japan, Day was declared. So the nature of total war meant that civilian populations caught in the crossfires and prisoners of war were victimized in this war at a rate that had never really before been seen. Axis powers used their conquered populations and POWs as slave laborers. For instance, in China, the Japanese had approximately 10 million working in conditions that are considered slave labor. Japanese and German officials conducted experiments on live human victims, doing things such as surgery with no anesthesia, infecting them with disease to quote-unquote study the effects, exposing them to hypothermia, and many other horrible conditions to see if they could determine ways to combat these extremes that humans deal with. Jews had been victimized in Europe for a long time, and increasingly so during the early years of Hitler's Nazi regime, as we discussed in the last episode. But in early 1942, plans for a final solution to the Jewish question were being articulated by the Nazis. Initially, mobile killing units known as Einsatzgruppen were moving through Jewish, Roma, and Slavic communities and executing the populations through mass shootings, which eventually resulted in the deaths of over a million Jews and thousands of Slavs and Roma. Now it was being discussed how to no longer simply remove, rather it was being planned to eliminate the Jewish population of Europe in a more efficient manner. Jews were to be transported from their neighborhoods or ghettos to camps in the east where they would die in transport, be worked as slaves, or be exterminated in a manufactured and horrific manner. The death camp that became most notorious was at Auschwitz, where over 1 million Jews were killed by poison gas and then cremated on a scale never before seen in human history. When all was said and done, what became known as the Holocaust would result in the deaths of approximately 6 million Jews. The perpetrators of the Final Solution would face the first charges of crimes against humanity at the Nuremberg trials. As World War I drew itself to a conclusion, the Cold War was just beginning. The final years of World War II witnessed the rising tensions, particularly between the United States and the Soviet Union, as the vision of the post-war world was being forged at several conferences. The Yalta Conference in early 1945 was where some of this distrust first became openly evident. The fate of Eastern Europe was in dispute as Churchill and President Roosevelt of the U.S. desired to see democratic elections in these states, while Stalin desired influence in this region so as to serve as a buffer from any more attacks on the USSR coming from the West. At Yalta, they also agreed to divide Germany among the four Allied powers, including France once again, and the plan to develop the United Nations that would help to promote international peace and security. The Potsdam Conference, which had taken place after German surrender but prior to Japanese surrender, saw a continuation of the same dispute. What eventually resulted was the Soviet influence that Stalin had desired at the expense of democracy in Eastern Europe. The fate of Eastern Europe falling to Soviet influence resulted in the emergence of the Cold War, an ideological struggle that was defined by increasing Soviet or American political influence and nuclear arms that failed to result in direct armed conflict between the two nations. The United States, seeing the spread of Soviet influence eastward in Europe, became committed to a belief known as containment, which desired to limit the spread of communist influence beyond where it already existed. The Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan were developed to help in this manner. The Truman Doctrine committed the United States to helping nations combating the spread of communism in any way they could, including military support, and this applied in particular at that time to Greece and Turkey in the 1950s. The Marshall Plan was intended to help rebuild the nations of Europe that had been destroyed by war with American funding and support, which ultimately drew the nations receiving Marshall Plan aid politically closer to the Americans. Finally, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was also created with the purpose of protecting its member nations from foreign threats. Not to be cornered, the Soviet Union responded to these efforts with their own plans and organizations. The Soviets developed a plan to counter the Marshall Plan, known as COMCON, which pledged to help Eastern Europe, and they created their own military alliance to counter NATO, known as the Warsaw Pact. Tensions in Europe, particularly a divided East and West Germany and Berlin, grew as a result of these developments, but I want to focus on the proxy wars and global tensions that emerged as a result of Soviet-American tensions. So the Korean Peninsula had been divided between the Soviet Union in the north along the 38th parallel and the United States and its allies to the south, just as we had seen Germany divided along the east-west border. North Korea drew a close relationship with the Soviet Union and newly communist China, which we'll discuss in more detail in the next episode. Unlike the case in Germany, war would break out on the peninsula and pit Soviet allies against America and its allies for the first time. Communist North Korea invaded the South with the purpose of uniting the two territories and establishing a single, unified communist state. Supported by the United Nations forces, the American military pushed the North Koreans out of the South and across the 38th parallel, even attempting to conquer the North and fully unify the country. This led to Chinese involvement as Allied forces became dangerously close to the Chinese border. American and United Nations forces were pushed back below the 38th parallel, and the conflict eventually settled out into an armistice between the North and the South. After 3 years of fighting, and with no side having the upper hand, a total of approximately 3 million would have died in this conflict. Another war of a very similar nature broke out in Vietnam, as American forces were sent to the south of that country to prevent a communist takeover by forces from the north. American involvement escalated during the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, who increased troop involvement by 1964. However, many Vietnamese in the south desired unification with the north, and they fought an insurgency from within against American forces bent on preventing countries falling to communism as if they were dominoes. The American military struggled to establish a secure foothold against the communists, and by the early 1970s, they began to withdraw from Vietnam. The North and South were united by 1975 under communist leadership. Backtracking a little bit, the 1960s saw other international crises that resulted in the United States squaring off directly against the Soviet Union, though just without arms. The Berlin Wall was constructed by communist East German forces in 1961 to prevent its citizens from fleeing into the capitalist western section of the city, drawing criticism from the Western world. But the bigger crisis occurred in Cuba, where in that same year, American-trained anti-communist Cubans invaded the Bay of Pigs in Cuba to launch an attack bent on overthrowing the nation's communist ruler, Fidel Castro. The invasion failed after 3 days, and it led to Soviet shipments of nuclear missiles to the island nation so as to serve as a preventative measure against more American-led interference. The United States learned of these nuclear missile sites in Cuba by 1962, and this resulted in what became known as the Cuban Missile Crisis. President John F. Kennedy demanded that Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev withdraw the missiles from Cuba or else deal with the consequences, which suggested possible nuclear war. The world seemed to hang on the nuclear edge in 1962, and eventually the Soviets decided to withdraw the missiles, while the U.S. agreed not to overthrow Castro and also remove its nuclear missiles located in Turkey. Crisis was averted for the time being, but tensions between the two superpowers would not begin to ease for a decade or more. I've mentioned in this episode both the genocide perpetrated by the Nazis, known as the Holocaust, and the war atrocities committed by the Japanese against the civilians of the nations they fought, particularly the Rape of Nanjing. For today's Complicating the Narrative, I wanted to address one of the most common questions I am asked year in and year out by students. They often want to know why we know so much about the Holocaust and yet so little about Japan's war atrocities. So I'll attempt to answer that question here. First, let's talk about Germany. After the war, there was a tremendous effort undertaken to address the sins committed by Germans in the Holocaust. The Nuremberg trials put the surviving architects of the genocide on trial for the world to see and laid their crimes out in the open. The German chancellor in the 1970s, Willy Brandt, traveled to Poland and visited the memorial for the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, where he fell to his knees and asked for the forgiveness of the Germans on a public display for all Polish survivors to see. The German educational system has also emphasized that its students learn about the crimes perpetrated during the Holocaust so that its citizens may learn a lesson and never again fall under the sway of a charismatic leader who can offer overly simplistic solutions to the complex problems facing its society. Memorials have been erected throughout Germany, paying tribute to those who lost their lives in the Holocaust, and each year its political leaders visit these memorials to pay respects on International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Lastly, Jews fled from Europe as refugees throughout the Western world, including the United States, in the wake of the Holocaust, and for decades they have been able to share their personal stories with American students who walk away from their experiences with an understanding of the human anguish brought about by Nazi war atrocities. The Japanese have had public officials express their regret and apologies for the crimes of the past, but they have done little else in the way of addressing the role of their countrymen in war atrocities. Japan has a memorial in Tokyo known as the Yasukuni Shrine, which is dedicated to the worship of those who have died for their country, including war criminals such as Hideki Tojo, who was executed for his crimes in 1948. Leaders in government make an annual visit to this site, which draws criticism from Japan's neighbors, because the vast majority of those Japanese to which the memorial is dedicated lost their lives in wars of expansion fought against China and Korea. Secondly, Japan's history curriculum in schools deals very little with the events of the 20th century. In an issue of BBC News magazine, Mariko Oi shared this about her textbook from her school days. Quote, "When we finally did get there, that is to the 20th century, it turned out only 19 of the book's 357 pages dealt with the events between 1931 and 1945. There was one page on what was known as the Mukden Incident, when Japanese soldiers blew up a railway in Manchuria in 1931. There was one page on other events leading up to the Sino-Japanese War in 1937, including one line in a footnote about the massacre that took place when Japanese forces invaded Nanjing, the Nanjing Massacre, or the Rape of Nanjing. There was another sentence on the Koreans and the Chinese who were brought to Japan as minors during the war, and one line, again, in a footnote, on comfort women, a prostitution corps created by the Imperial Army of Japan. There was also just one sentence on the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki," end quote. Stanford History Education Group provides a quote from New History Textbook, published in Tokyo in 2005, that describes the Rape of Nanjing as follows. Quote, "In August 1937, two Japanese soldiers, one an officer, were shot to death in Shanghai, the hub of foreign interests. After this incident, the hostilities between Japan and China escalated. Japanese military officials thought Chiang Kai-shek would surrender if they captured Nanking, the nationalist capital. They occupied that city in December. But Chiang Kai-shek had moved his capital to the remote city of Chongqing. The conflict continued," end quote. So this lack of addressing its guilt in the past really complicates matters. And I think also that China's relative isolation from the world after World War II has led to less of a global awareness of what happened during the Japanese occupation as well. Nations have to reckon with their past, no matter how horrific it is, so they're able to navigate the modern world with a balanced perspective of how their nation has acted, how it currently acts, and how it hopes to act in the future. Nations, just like people, have their triumphs and tragedies, and failure to understand this only creates resentment and antagonism on the international stage. So today's document in focus comes from President Harry Truman, who made this statement on the situation in Korea on June 27, 1950. He says, quote, "In South Korea, the government forces, which were armed to prevent border raids and to preserve internal security, were attacked by invading forces from North Korea. The Security Council of the United Nations called upon the invading troops to cease hostilities and to withdraw to the 30th parallel. This they have not done, but on the contrary have pressed the attack. The Security Council called upon all members of the United Nations to render every assistance to the United Nations in the execution of this resolution. In these circumstances, I have ordered United States air and sea forces to give the Korean government troops cover and support," end quote. So the context of this document is that it's produced 2 days after North Korean forces invaded the South with the intent of unifying the peninsula under one communist government. When this happened, the UN Security Council, that's the five-member group, at least five permanent member group within the UN, that was able to use military force if necessary, demanded that North Korean forces withdraw back north across the 38th parallel. However, the Soviets were not present on the Security Council at that time because they were protesting the UN's refusing to allow Communist China onto the Security Council, instead keeping the Nationalist Republic of China on the Security Council until 1971. If you just read the Truman excerpt and don't understand the context, it may seem like the Soviet Union supported the idea that Communist North Korea should stop its activity, but now you know this is not the case. They were absent from the Security Council when this resolution was drafted. The day after this statement, June 28, 1950, the Security Council again met without the USSR and agreed to use force against North Korea. This action paved the way for the beginning of the Korean War, as President Truman never asked for a declaration of war from Congress, in spite of their support for armed intervention. So there are two videos that I want to recommend to you in this episode that I think are essential viewing to understanding the course of the war and the toll it took on human life. The first video comes from Geo History on YouTube, and it summarizes the causes, course, and effects of World War II by charting its progression on a world map. If you'd like an approximately 10-minute overview of the war, look absolutely nowhere else. Lastly, the video called The Fallen of World War II is astonishing in its way to calculate and present the statistical damage of World War II on human life. Rare has been the moment in my class where you can hear collective gasps come from most students, and it happens each year as I play this video. Go to fallen.io on your internet browser and check out the interactive feature. It's well worth your time. All right, well, I think that's about it for this episode. Surprisingly, I've covered World War II and the first 20 or so years of the Cold War in about a half an hour time. I don't know how I did it, but I did. So let's call it a day. Take care, everyone.